Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, The First Omen. This movie is a prequel to the 1976 classic, The Omen, and it's a directorial debut, remarkable, for Arkasha Stevenson, who also has a writing credit on it. It stars Nell Tiger Free, Ralph Ineson, Sonia Braga, Charles Dance, Bill Nighy, Maria Caballero, and a lot more. Now, this is going to be a spoiler-free review since this movie is relatively new, until it's not, and I'll give a heads up when the spoiler part is coming later in the episode. I called this movie the best horror movie of 2024 that's meant to be scary so far, and what I meant by that was I was primarily thinking of Lisa Frankenstein, which I loved, but clearly is not meant to be a frightening movie in any sense, still in the horror genre. First Omen is clearly trying to scare you, and of the movies that are like that, in that breed, I think it's the best so far. I'll make the case. A very intelligent critique of this movie came my way via the Horror Weekly community, particularly a subscriber. Thank you so much for subscribing and directly helping keep this thing going and growing. And her thoughts on it really got to me. So I'm going to grapple with how she changed my mind in some senses about what this movie is. And I'm curious to see what I think of it when I do the end of the year wrap up and where I rank it ultimately among the movies of the year. Now, let's get into the first and most obvious comparison outside the Omen universe, which is Immaculate, just by recency bias, because Immaculate essentially just came out. And these two movies obviously have a lot in common. But this is really, and I liked Immaculate a lot. I recorded a review in a previous episode if you didn't hear it and want to go check it out. But as much as high a regard as I had for Immaculate, there were a couple of really big things weirdly missing from that movie for me. Primarily the villain, which I thought was the most forgettable villain in a good horror movie in recent memory. So that really kind of impacted my enjoyment of the movie in a certain sense. But The First Omen has highlighted another thing that is missing from Immaculate that I find interesting, which is religion. Now you're thinking to yourself, what the hell is he talking about? How is religion missing from Immaculate? Well, The First Omen is steeped in religion, and we're going to get to that. But Immaculate, oddly, if you think back on it and you've seen it, imagine changing the build of that movie slightly and making it more like a Game of Thrones situation. A group of people are trying to save a baby or get a baby birthed that is a dynastic successor, someone who will come to power and claim the Iron Throne and rule everything and make everyone that helped the baby powerful and rich. And all they got to do is get the baby born and then keep it safe and raise it until it's old enough to kind of like seize power. It would play out almost exactly the same way Immaculate does. Almost nothing in Immaculate is predicated on religion. I know that sounds crazy because it's set in a convent and everyone's wearing religious clothes and whatever. But when I think back on Immaculate, there was really no sense I got from any of the villains that they were particularly devoutly religious in any way. They did a couple chants. They clearly live in a religious setting, but that's really kind of a masquerade for what they're actually up to. And when they're talking about the things they're trying to accomplish, it's really about unleashing something terrible on the world. And ironically, the only actually devout character in that movie seems to be Sydney Sweeney's character. Everybody else is kind of out for their own dark dream. The First Omen has a very similar plot line of the church basically trying to bring about the advent of the Antichrist to turn people back to the church. But the people who are involved in this are clearly absolutely devout and committed in their own insane, off-kilter way. My point being, I can't think of a character in The First Omen that isn't devout, either to a holy cause or unholy. Maybe Carlita, I guess. She would be the closest to really trapped in a situation and maybe not necessarily super religious about it. There's that famous moment in Jurassic Park when Jeff Goldblum, after the initial tour that they're being taken on, yields no actual dinosaurs before all hell breaks loose. The people on the tour don't see any dinosaurs, and he taps the camera inside the car or Jeep or whatever and says, looking into the camera, knowing Hammond is watching them, are there going to be actually any actual dinosaurs on this dinosaur ride? And Hammond responds, I really hate that man. Well, I'm tapping on Immaculate and being like, is there ever going to be any actual religion in your religious movie? And The First Omen goes the opposite direction. Honestly, I feel like it's even more religious than the 1976 original The Omen. And to me, this is a good and powerful thing in this kind of movie. And the reason I think so is because there's no God in the movie. And that makes everything weirdly off balance. You have tons of religious people, most of them having an agenda that I would imagine most viewers would disagree with their agenda. You have a rising sense of evil enveloping everything and insinuating its way into every circumstance, into all the characters' lives, the characters we care about. So you've got evil, and you've got religious people all over the place, and you've got religion like a fog weaving in and out of every circumstance, but not a sign of God. What did Devil's Advocate call him? An absentee landlord? That's the feeling you get in this movie. Now, in Devil's Advocate, even though Al Pacino's character says that, he's wrong. You get a very strong sense of God in The Devil's Advocate. You get a feeling that when everything comes right in the end, spoiler for Devil's Advocate, I guess, it's because God knew it was going to come right or helped guide it along to become right for the characters that deserved it. There is no guiding hand in The First Omen. Now, if evil is the structure of this movie and the characters populate the movie, imagine the movie like a jet, right? So you've got the characters in the seats, and the body of the plane is basically evil because evil is enveloping everything. God should be the pilot. So imagine being on a plane, sitting in your chair, and all of a sudden finding out at 30,000 feet, you know, hundreds of miles away from your destination, that your pilot has vanished into thin air. It's a terrifying feeling. And the universe in The First Omen is a pilotless careening jet. And worse, there's a segment of people in the seats of the airplane you're on who think they know who the perfect replacement for that pilot should be. And they start pointing to the rear of the plane, and you hear an evil snarling like an animal coming from the back. Welcome to your new pilot. Now, a lot of the times in the older horror movies, one of the drawbacks of leaning so heavily on the religious elements is that you give into a sort of misogyny or what the patriarchy of the church makes the movie imbalanced in that way. But Arkasha Stevenson is not afraid of that. She takes this challenge head on and addresses it in how the characters handle themselves. And a lot of how they do that contains spoilers, so I'll get to this later at the end of the episode. But clearly, one thing that isn't a giveaway is by making pregnancy the lever that moves the entire plot. And in this case, making someone pregnant with the Antichrist against their will, it's clearly not looking away from what a disadvantage it is that this movie takes place in a universe where women are usable. Now, I've seen a lot of people online trying to figure out where to situate this movie. Like, where does it rank in the Omen franchise? I think it's clearly second. Where does it compare to other horror prequels? Someone in the Horror Weekly community gave their one-line review of this as saying that this prequel achieved what the Thing 2011 prequel tried to achieve and failed to do. But I want to situate it in terms of quality and where I think it's going to land in terms of horror legacy. And by doing that, I want to talk about how beautiful the movie is, which is not just a testament to Arkasha Stevenson, again, in her debut as a feature director, although she worked on the fantastic Channel Zero series, a series that I feel like, or at least among the people who love horror that I know, has been weirdly forgotten, but is a series that I loved, particularly her season. She worked on the season Butcher's Block and then No End House. And those were my two favorite seasons. But in Channel Zero, the visuals, when you think about that stairway to the sky, you think about the visuals from Butcher's Block that season, a lot of the story was just told in very mysterious visuals without a lot of language needed to forward the plot or where it was going. And it had a sense of mystery to it. And she brings that to the first Omen. But the cinematographer of the first Omen is a man named Aaron Morton. And he was the director of photography on 2013's Evil Dead remake, or whatever you want to call that. And that Evil Dead 2013 is exactly where I think the first Omen is going to land in terms of horror quality. Whatever you think of Evil Dead 2013, you can hate it, love it. You can, you know, everyone has opinions, right? But generally speaking, my grasp of where Evil Dead 2013 has landed in terms of horror fandom at large, in mass, is that it's one of the best kind of things of its kind. And I think the first Omen ultimately is going to be equal sign to Evil Dead 2013. And that's a coincidence because it has a person who was really responsible for a lot of the visual elements of Evil Dead is a person who did the cinematography for this. There are just so many ravishing shots in this movie that you could imagine printing out high quality and putting up on your wall as a horror fan and getting a smile on your face every time you walk into that room. I think even the people who hate The First Omen are admitting that it's a gorgeous film. And I think this is really my biggest argument for this movie, is that it seems to be a perfect storm of talent. But between the director just doing an incredible job for having it be her first feature film, to the stacked cast, which there isn't a bad performance in this entire movie. Even like the bit characters, like Sister Angelica, who ends up reenacting the "it's all for you" kind of moment from the original movie, which was a visually great scene, but unfortunately, this is one of the weaker points of this movie, is that it was the on-the-nose callbacks were a little heavy-handed. But my God, I looked her up to see what she's acted in before, just to see who she was. And when I Googled it, the thumbnail of her standing on the ledge in the first Omen, it was a close-up of her face. And she looks like someone who has just been through the world's worst lifetime ever. Just her face is distorted with despair and insanity, and also like very tired of it all, but like electric with energy because she's about to do the thing that she believes is her last act, her last necessary act before she can get off this fucking planet. And it all kinds of comes across in this one facial expression. And she is barely in this movie. And the movie is quality performances top to bottom. And I guess I'm going to have to get into spoilers from here on out. So here's your warning. They'll start small and get bigger as we go. But Maria Caballero, I really want to highlight here as... So she's given very little to do. It's not that the character is badly written. She just doesn't have a lot to do. She's basically playing a friend and supporter of Margaret, the main character, and a roommate at points. And then she turns very possibly sinister, let's say. And to do this with just facial expressions and very little screen time, she actually becomes quite terrifying in this movie just by her look and what she is kind of up to. And it's really remarkable that she was able to pull it off with just the grains of sand that she was given in terms of the recipe of this movie. But let's get to the apex predator of acting in this movie. And amazingly, no, it's not Ralph Ineson. No, it's not Charles Dance. No, it's not Bill Nighy. It's Nell Tiger Free. Now, if you have seen the first Omen, quick off the top of your head, I'll pause. Try to think of a scene she wasn't in. I know you can't. I can't either. I'm sure there is one. But to have to carry an entire movie like this with all your, you know, what movie experiences she have? She was, I know she was in Servant and was fantastic in it. There's a scene later in this film where she's just in a room with Ralph Ineson. And I swear to God, if you knew nothing about like their past or their accolades or anything, and you just watched it, I felt like her performance was stronger. And I love Ralph Ineson. This is amazing. It's not even like I'm trying to make a competition between them. It's kind of like the scenes in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with that amazing prodigy little girl that's sitting next to Leonardo DiCaprio's character and telling him about Walt Disney and her acting preparation techniques. Here you have someone relatively new in the business, at least age-wise, and just dominating the screen. It's remarkable. And so here's the thing. Actors, and even more to the point, audiences, love the big showy acting moments, the you can't handle the truth moments. And there are moments in the first Omen where Nell Tiger Free gets to do like the big dramatic sweeping scenes, the character reveals and the you know, the convulsions, which are clearly towards the end of the movie, which are clearly an homage to Isabel Adjani in Possession. She gets to do all of this and more, the big scary moments, the big, you know, bloody moments. But it's really early on in the movie that she establishes what an incredibly talented actor she is, because she was completely believable and organic as a kind of character that is going to join, devote their life to religion in a way that, let's face it, the vast majority of the population don't do to that level of extremity, to give up all kinds of like worldly desires and possessions and whatnot, and just do this kind of thing, and to still be a real believable character, like someone you think that you could meet at a gathering and like and get along with and believe was a real three-dimensional person. I don't even think, and this isn't a criticism of Sydney Sweeney's acting at all, but I don't think they even established that in Immaculate that well. I mean, she has a kind of, you know, native charm that she's using to get that character across to you, but I'm not sure I ever believed. Matter of fact, they had to write this mystical backstory, like, you know, I was saved from drowning and, like, you know, I had felt like I had to devote the rest of my life to God or whatever. But you clearly feel like that could be a mistake, right? In this movie, it's clear that because of the outcomes that Nell Tigerfree was backing the wrong horse with her religious devotion in this case. But you don't believe that it was because she made a mental error or that it was a character flaw or anything like that. It's just bad luck. But she seems like the kind of person that can live in both worlds, I guess is what I'm saying. She's the kind of person that if I invited you all over to, you know, let's, you know, we're making this podcast together. I poll the community all the time. Your voice is featured on the podcast all the time. In terms of your comments and opinions or whatever. So let's just get together and have a big party. And if her character from The First Omen was there in the room, I think all of us would be like, wow, we really like this person. Glad she came. And, you know, here come the big spoilers from now on out. So, you know, the thing is, as any person who's watched a lot of horror movies, you have to suspect everybody. So when you're first watching a movie, everyone who's being nice, you're like, yeah, I don't know. Like, whatever. As a matter of fact, that's more suspicious than the people who are being like kind of mean, because then you're like, well, the movie's just giving us a mean character. There's no trickery there, right? Unless they want a redemption arc or something. But the point is, you're always suspicious of like every character. She was so genuine. She was so dogged and determined about saving Carlita and making sure Carlita wasn't, you know, unnecessarily abused by the religious system she found herself enmeshed in, that I forgot my suspicions of her as someone who might turn out to be one of the evil characters. And she doesn't turn out to be one of the evil characters. But what she does do is turn out to have a very dark force to her, and she turns out to be the mother of the Antichrist. Or I guess I should more accurately say, in the universe of this movie, the mother of the Antichrist and sibling. But she sells all those early scenes of someone wide-eyed arriving in Rome and just taking it all in and trying to do a good job, of someone who's awkward at a party, but then because she has so much force of personality inside of her, quickly adapts to the scenario of the party and becomes very lively, very into it. Not like, you know, oh, I'm so shocked at what everyone's doing. Oh, they're drinking and oh, they're showing legs and like whatever. Like, she doesn't play with any of that. Like, it's not... her character's too well written, and she's too good of an actor for that. You can tell that she's just a really strong, interesting person who suffers from lack of experience in certain situations, but quickly recalibrates to get on top of the situation. And all of this is conveyed in her acting throughout the course of the entire movie. By the time the reveal of her being at the heart of this conspiracy unwillingly, you know, minutes before that reveal happens that this is probably where it's headed. And then she has to be shocked and in despair from the discovery of it. And you're ahead of her as the audience, most likely. So her shock can be like, okay, like, how surprised could you be if we weren't surprised? That's a very hard scene to pull off. But again, completely does it in a very realistic way. And the downfall of a lot of acting performances for things like this are the tricky moments. If you've ever watched the movie Free Solo, or you've seen, like, you know, really difficult climbing videos, there's these key moments where you're changing, you know, footholds or handholds, or there's certain places on the rock where everything, you know, it's live or die there. And the in-between path is sort of routine. Well, that's one of those moments in this movie for her as an actor, is the, oh my God, I'm the mother of the Antichrist moment. And you know, and you, when you think about the ending of Rosemary's Baby, nothing against Rosemary's Baby, but basically Mia Farrow's, you know, oh my God, I'm the mother of the Antichrist moment is the entire ending of the movie. And it's that shocked expression on her face. And then it's the, oh my God, I can't believe this. Oh my God, I can't believe this. Oh my God, I can't believe this some more. It's basically the same acting all the way from the reveal to the final end of the movie, with like the slight change of, you know, I want to take care of my child or whatever. But that's a pretty easy transition to go, I'm a mother, I love my baby, like whatever. But it's basically, oh my God, shocked face, you know, through the entire finale of Rosemary's Baby. In this movie, what Nell Tiger Free does is darker and more interesting, actually. She gets frightening. She's scared, clearly, herself. But she becomes one of the frightening things of the movie, not in a villain sense. And that's the really interesting part. In the just power sense, she becomes frightening in the way that a sudden landslide is frightening. At first, you don't know what's happening. And before you know what's happening, an entire mountain is heading towards you. Nell Tiger Free gets a really fierce glimmer in her eye. Her hair goes crazy. Her body language gets, I don't even know. She's like a crouching, like a jaguar, kind of. It's really something that makes this movie special. What else makes this movie special? The score. The music is just insanely good. This is from Mark Corvin, who did The Witch and The Lighthouse and also The Black Phone. He incorporates the great Jerry Goldsmith at just the right time and just the right way, but also does a lot of his own thing, which is just perfect for this movie. Now, you'll notice, I think, that I didn't, and I'm not going to do any kind of like real walkthrough of the plot. I didn't feel like doing that with this movie, just because it's very similar to Immaculate, and it's very similar to a lot of religious horror movies, but particularly Immaculate. And I just reviewed that and didn't feel like walking through the same kind of like plot points again. But there's a couple important things about the story this movie is telling and important scenes that I just don't want to leave untouched. So first of all, because this is a prequel to The Omen, it's set in, I think it's 1971, early 70s. And amazingly, it feels like it's really there. It's so difficult to do this right and not just be like a nostalgia film and actually make it feel like it's taking place and really being filmed at the time that it's set in. If you watch John Carpenter's The Thing and then the 2011 The Thing, they just feel like they're set. They feel like they're taking place almost on two different planets. Like things are so different. The look is so different. The feel, the vibes are so different. I'm really looking forward to streaming The First Omen as part of a double bill with the original The Omen. And the fact that I just saw this in the theaters and I'm already thinking about streaming it is a good sign. But I feel like watching these two movies back to back, even though they're filmed nearly 50 years apart, won't be jarring because of the craftsmanship that the makers of The First Omen put into making it feel genuinely 70s. Now, if you haven't seen it and you're going to go see it in the theaters, don't be late, because the opening scene is spectacular. It's not just a great horror moment. It's gorgeous it's more normal than Suspiria, but gorgeous in the way that Suspiria's opening was, at least for a flash. And although the death in this moment is a riff on a famous bolt from above death in the original movie, they did two really interesting things to distinguish this, besides just making it gorgeous to look at and chilling, and having great actors in the scene. The first thing is, whereas the death in the original movie is the adding of an object to a person getting skewered, but the object is basically added to their body, that's what I was expecting again to happen in this one. And it was shot very cleverly in the angles that it was showing you to, or at least for me, to make me think that I was just getting a redux of a kill that I already saw, just updated and modernized. But instead, what happens here is someone's getting something subtracted from their body, and it is a great shot. It got a big reaction from the crowd in the theater that I was at. And then the other distinguishing thing about this moment is the angelic, beatific smile that Charles Dance gives at this moment, which is really hard to read. Part of it you could read as brain damage. Part of it you can read as relief, because he literally was just saying that he doesn't want to be forgiven. He just wants this all to be over. But giving an almost like runway model smile to this actor and this character in this moment, if it was given, if it wasn't improvised, is a very strange choice. And it works perfectly because it's like a brushback pitch in baseball. It kept me as an audience member off my toes, off balance, because it was odd. And I was like, if this movie can make this choice here, what other choices can it make later on? And to be honest with you, I haven't been able to get his freaking smile out of my mind since I saw the movie. So it definitely worked on me as an effective moment. The disco scene is a really interesting moment because it has one meaning when you first see it. Again, big spoilers coming. And another meaning once you realize retroactively what was actually going on. And I love when a good movie does this because it made me feel bad about what I had felt when I had watched the scene originally. It went backwards in time and twisted the dials, turned the knobs on the emotional settings I had for when I had seen the scene on the first pass through. So when you first see the disco scene, again, at least for me, I was definitely rooting for Margaret. I wanted her to get this one experience of what she was giving up in the world to go live the life that she was living. Not necessarily to turn her against her or tempt her out of it. Actually, given her, you know, honest sense of conviction and mission, you know, I wasn't rooting for that at all. But it's always better to know. It's like only dating one person your entire life. Like you date one person, you fall in love with them, you get married, and that's it. You'll never know what it's like to have dated anyone else ever. Like, is that good or is that bad? Well, like in this case, I was rooting for her to at least be able to have the experience to let loose, feel that side of herself. And even if she was giving it up ultimately later on, at least she would be a little more knowledgeable, a little less naive about the choice, the huge lifestyle choice she was making. I was also rooting for her because the chemistry she had between her friend and the person she met at the disco was electric. It was really powerful. It was really good. So you're rooting for it. Now, in the back of my mind, even on the first pass of the scene, it felt like a little pushy, like a little exploitative would be too strong, but like a little forcing someone into something because of exactly the reasons I just said, because that's the reason her friend, Maria Caballero, again, great performance, gave her as the justification for why we should be drinking, why should we should be dancing with boys, why should we should be going out at all when we're going to be becoming nuns. But the manner in which she did it to Margaret did feel a little pushy, but I put that aside and it just became like a great dance scene, like the Fright Night moment with Chris Sarandon and Amanda Bearse in a way. And then later on, you find out that this is all part of a plot against her. And it turns horrifying. And what happened during those moments turns horrifying, like Rosemary's Baby-esque horrifying. And then because you were rooting for it at the time, you're implicated as the audience member, as a viewer, in kind of rooting for a character's destruction, even though you didn't mean to be doing it. The movie makes you a little complicit in it by how it manipulates you in that scene, and then how it parcels out the reveal of the true meaning of that scene, what it meant. And I love when a movie does that, when a movie takes a feeling that you had on the first pass and makes it more complicated ultimately than what you got. This is something, by the way, that's really special to great movies of all kinds, whether they're comedies or dramas or thrillers. I mean, it's easy to give you like a thrill ride, like when I'm watching The Equalizer, which are really well done movies, like the whole series is really well done, and I love the latest installment because it's basically a slasher in disguise. But I don't remember ever thinking in The Equalizer that something I felt when a scene was happening was different at the end of the movie than how I'd felt about it originally. When he's alone and he's kind of keeping to himself and he's getting drawn into doing the equalizing, I remember thinking, oh my God, just leave this poor guy alone. He's retired. He just lets me out. When he takes revenge, I remember thinking, all right, well, he took revenge on this person because they're a bad person. And then the more you find out about the people he's taking revenge on, the worse people they end up being. So your original feeling of, you know, he's justified in his revenge is just confirmed. You're just having the same feeling, but bigger. And that's how a lot of movies operate. But in The First Omen, there are several moments where you feel one way, and then when you look back on the movie, you're like, oh, gross, why did I feel that way? And what's especially cool about that is that's the experience that Margaret is having. She's constantly having to reevaluate the things that she thought were true. So in a strange way, you're having a parallel experience as a viewer as the main character is having. And I think that's magnificent. Another thing that's great is when a movie turns a character's virtue against them. Now, let's look at the opposite of that to illustrate kind of what I'm saying, right? Like, Hannibal Lecter hates people, essentially. And because he hates them, he eats them, right? I know it's psychologically a lot more complex, but let's just like simplify for the sake of this argument, right? That's not a virtue, though. Him hating people is not a virtue. It's a characteristic. It's a mark of his personality. He's very polite, right? That's typically a virtue in a character. Does it get turned against him? Does he ever pay a price for being polite? No, it's always to his advantage, right? Like, it helps him pass in society. It helps him trick people. It helps him put people at ease before he like mind games them or manipulates them or whatever. So it's a thing that would theoretically be a virtue, and it's always something that plays in his favor. Margaret in The First Omen is helpful and she's curious. Well, if I told you that I wanted you to introduce you to a friend of mine, and I was like, you're going to really like her. She's a really helpful person by nature, and she's very curious. Sounds great, right? Like, what, you're going to object to meeting this person, to my friend? Like, no, helpful and courteous sounds awesome. Margaret is helpful and courteous. And in the amazing death scene, car crash death scene, where her brief Roman fling is bisected by a car, her helpfulness and her courteousness are both turned against her in really wicked ways, right? So she's very curious. She sees him walking by. She stops the driver of the car that she's in. She gets out and she starts running after him because she's curious. She wants to figure out what happened that night that she didn't remember and why. She's really curious because he's running away from her or avoiding her. And now she's like, why? So the more she chases him, the more frenzied he gets and the more perilous the situation becomes. So her curiosity is putting both her and him in danger. And it's already been established in this movie that because of the roiling protests that are happening in Rome, the streets aren't safe. And she's just running around the streets being curious. So it's a virtue, but it's working against her. And then he gets hit by a car in an amazing way that becomes an amazing horror movie moment. And he's trapped by the car. He can't move. And she wants to help. She's a helpful person. So she lifts him out of his predicament. But the lifting, let's say it's not helpful in its effect. And this is particularly effective in Antichrist type movies because, like, for instance, what's a black mass? It's a regular mass reversed, right? A pentagram right side up is supposedly a good thing. An upside down pentagram, bad thing. Demons in you know, devil movies oftentimes speak in reverse. It's an upside down world. And in an upside down world, your virtues might be your vices, and it might work the other way as well. So the fact that the good sides of her character keep biting her in the ass is a mark that she's living in an upside down universe. And that's really fitting for this kind of film. I'm probably a little bit stupid or a little too enthusiastic when I watch movies, like I'm too into the world. So I somehow did not anticipate that Margaret was going to get thrown into the bad room where Carlita has been spending a lot of her time. And that's when it really becomes clear that Carlita and they're having an almost twin-like experience. And that's when it hit me watching the movie that another great little nuance to Nell Tiger Free's performance is that she was acting like, I'm going to put it in a way that's kind of fucked up, and I'm sorry, I just can't think of a better way to explain it. But like, if you've ever met a recovered smoker, some of them can be really obnoxious about smoking. Right now, I think I warrant it. It's fine, whatever. But the point is, like, people can get really evangelical about things that they've gotten over when they used to do something and now they don't. And now they feel really preachy about, like, no one should ever do this, like, whatever. You know, forgetting the fact that they did it themselves, right? Now, Carlita's doing a lot of sulking and hallucinating and lurking and, you know, giving evil Kubrick stares throughout this movie. And now her character, Margaret, it keeps referring to a past that she had where she's like, I was a problem child. I caused a lot of trouble. I got rebuked a lot. And even her friends or the people who know her are like, really? Because you seem like so, you know, sweet and on top of it and positive now. It's kind of hard to picture. And she's like, oh yeah, you know, because, you know, I'm better. I've learned how to, ground myself in reality and know the hallucinations aren't real and know, like, blah, blah, blah. And she kind of deals with Carlita in a slightly condescending way, even though she's really nice to her and really being helpful. But I don't think she ever sees coming the turn of events where she's going to end up in the bad room where everyone around just basically sees her as another Carlita. And she's also now again questioning whether what she's seeing is real, what she's hearing is real. She's having outbursts. She's acting erratic. She's basically getting treated the way she was in the distant past when she thought she was flawed. In this case, it's not her flaw. It's the people around her flaw. But still, I don't think she ever saw it coming. She's really rocked by being ending up in the bad room. And I just thought it was a really nice grace note to her performance. Now, I'm sure some of you listening have been amazed at how I have not addressed at any point how this movie affects the lore of The Omen. And I know that that is confusing a lot of people and irritating a lot of people that I talk to and that I see online. And I just have to confess to you, I don't fucking care. It's not a cop out. It's not like I'm judging anyone who does deeply care about it. It's fine. The thing is, sadly, The Omen is one of the weakest franchises in horror. Right now, to you Omen fans out there, I love it too. Like, I have just as much fun watching The Omen 2 or The Omen 3 or like whatever. And I've seen a few of them multiple times. I even liked the 2006 remake. I mentioned it on a previous podcast. They had like June 6, 2006 coming. How could they not remake The Omen and release it at that time? And it had a really good cast. And I thought it was a workable, you know, production. I thought it was enjoyable. I didn't think it was great. You know, I thought it was fine. But like up till now, take the Hellraiser franchise, which is a famously uneven franchise. There are films in there that I really like. I had one of my favorite comprehensive horror books on movies I've ever read is a book on Hellraiser films and their legacy. So I happily read about, you know, Hellraisers 4, 5, 6, like it's fine. But there are two masterpieces in the Hellraiser franchise, Hellraiser 1 and Hellraiser 2. And then there are some enjoyable movies and some terrible movies. And then, you know, the reboots or whatever you want to call that thing, which I enjoyed, but again, didn't think it was a spectacular moment for horror. So that's two masterpieces in a franchise. And the Hellraiser franchise is not considered one of the strongest franchises in horror. Movie, sure, of course. Capera movies, you know, fine, absolutely. But as a franchise, you know, I don't know. The Amityville franchise is probably a better analog because it's really only got one great movie in it. And then the Amityville 2 is decent. And then, you know, however you feel about the remake, which I didn't enjoy as much as the Hellraiser remake, but again, is still very watchable. Well, the Omen franchise only has one masterpiece in it up to now. It has nothing else. I mean, it's only a franchise because they made a bunch of movies. It didn't even manage to have, you know, one great and one really good movie in it. It's one great movie and then a bunch of, if you grew up with them, fun movies. If this kind of movie appeals to you, fun movies. If you're just really into like Sam Neill or particulars of some movies, you know, it's great. If you dig the atmosphere of it, if you were such a big fan of the first one that you just needed more from that universe, then it was there for you, right? But just if you were rating on a scale of 1 to 10, like Hellraiser's a 9.5 and Hellraiser 2 is also a 9 or 9.5 even. Some people think it's better than the first one, right? And then Hellraiser 3 is like a 5.5 or 6. I kind of like Hellraiser 3. Let's give it a 6. And then you go on, right? The Omen is a 9, the original. And then The Omen 2 is like a 3. And it doesn't go up from there. So now, as far as I'm concerned, the Omen franchise has a 9 and then like a 8.9. in it now because of the first Omen. And if it changed a little bit of the lore, if it tweaked a little bit of the lore in some way that disturbs you as a Super Omen fan, I mean, I'm sorry, but this movie has single-handedly made this an interesting franchise instead of a one-off great with a bunch of, you know, cabooses attached. And it gave us a director to really watch. I mean, I was really impressed by the direction in this movie. So let's do a thought experiment, right? Let's say that you could get in a time machine and you could replace David Gordon Green out of the Halloween reboot trilogy and put Arkasha Stevenson into it. Would you do it? I've been a defender of Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends at points. And I liked Halloween 2008 well enough. But I think that I would be more excited at the chance of getting to see a Halloween reboot trilogy out of Arkasha Stevenson based on what I saw from the first Omen than anything that I ultimately got from the Halloween trilogy. I wouldn't use my time machine to swap her out with the director of It Chapter 1, but I might give her It Chapter 2. And oh my God, can you imagine putting the Exorcist Believer or whatever that, whatever the hell is going on with the return of the Exorcist universe into her hands instead of what we got? Now, supporter of Horror Weekly, Umberto Faris said that it was a pleasure to see his hometown featured throughout the movie. Rome is still a beautiful city. The first Omen could have been a disaster, and I'm glad it wasn't. I give it a 666 rating. Go see it. I'm pretty sure it's the first time we get a prequel featuring a bifurcated ending. I can see sequels on the way, unlike any other traditional spinoffs in the genre. And it is interesting how they ended this prequel to be able to spin off in a different direction, but also incorporating the original. But it was another supporter in the subscriber group. And in case you are interested in joining and helping out and being part of the community, I'll put a link in the show notes. I read every comment there, as you can see. So Tracy V said, and I wish I could find the comment. It's in a post that is that I can't locate at the moment. But the gist of it was that she found the first Omen a little disappointing. She thought the homage to Isabella Gianni's Possession was a weak sauce, and that it was ripping off some moments from other movies. And basically it just felt like her take on it or impression of it was that it felt a little derivative and not scary. Now, here's the thing about this. I think she's right in the parts where this movie is derivative of the It's All For You, Damien, or direct homages to other movies, or the thing to Possession, that it did feel a little on the nose. It felt like it was a little too... It almost takes you out of the movie because then you realize you're watching a movie and you're not experiencing a world. I found this movie scary enough. I mean, it's very hard to scare horror fans who have seen, you know, thousands of horror movies like I have over time, or like I'm sure most of you have. So we're a little jaded. I'm not expecting to be terrified like I was when I was a kid. I would say that it got under my skin at parts and that I found it unnerving. And then I appreciated that even though it tried a couple jump scares, it kept those to the beginning of the movie and worked its way out of it and didn't rely on them during the... It's almost like the movie grew up as it went. But I've learned not to judge what kind of movie scares one person or doesn't scare the other. The only thing I'm really interested in as a person that runs a horror community is kind of what the aggregate is, right? Like the aggregate... the majority of horror fans agree that something like Jaws has scary moments in it. There are very few horror fans that are like, oh my God, everything in Jaws sucks. The aggregate of horror fans agree there's nothing scary in Lisa Frankenstein, right? I think a good chunk of horror fans, especially younger ones who aren't as jaded, I think at least a majority of them will find this movie scary, or at least having some scary, impactful moments. I think it'll outright rattle a few people. I feel like for a generation of horror fans, or at least everyone I talk to in a certain generation of horror fans, they were all terrified by Phantasm. Like everyone, almost everyone was terrified by Phantasm. I don't know if that's possible among horror fandom anymore. It's a little late in the movie making game. We're not this. You know, industry is more than 100 years old. I just don't know. I can't even think of the last movie off the top of my head where if I was trying to like come up with a movie that I felt like 80% of horror fans who saw it found it scary. I don't even know what movie I would say of any recent movies. tell me what you think. You can message the Horror Weekly page on Facebook and let me know. I'd be really interested in what you think the last great consensus scary movie was. I almost want to say it's Hereditary, but I don't know if that gets to 8 out of 10 from the discourse that I see online. So again, I'm not judging like the scare factor. That's a very personal thing, but I feel like this movie was unnerving to me and made me nervous at the sight of shadows, which is about as much as I can ask for a movie that's not like outright terrifying. And then I suspect, and this is a big issue, maybe something I'll delve into in more detail on a future podcast, because I find the whole notion fascinating, but the expectations that we go into movies now with are off the charts. Like, I mean, there's never been anything like this. We're going into movies armed with so much knowledge, peripheral knowledge, you know, trailers, behind the scenes clips, you know, interviews with the creators and actors and everyone involved with it before it even comes out, advanced reviews, knowledge of, you know, previous works by whoever's doing it or whatever company it's from, or even judging just by whatever rating it is. And by the way, this movie was almost NC-17 rated based on that, the birth scene, which I can't believe I didn't talk about, but there's, you know, a very graphic birth scene where a hand emerges that, again, really freaked out the audience I saw it with in the theater, at least. But I just feel like the expectations we go into movies with, along with kind of the disposable nature of entertainment in general now, where there's a million things coming out. It's like drinking out of a fire hose between all the streaming apps. And if you are still going to theaters, it didn't feel this way in the past, not so long ago. It felt like a movie could stand out and be special a little bit more. I just keep coming back to the word disposable. And so I think some of how you experience this movie or any horror movie that comes out, you know, recently, it might also be kind of in a matrix of expectations affecting how it impacts you as well. But I just imagine Tracy sitting there watching the same movie I watched. She's a super smart person, just thinking, yeah, I'm not buying this. Not buying this at all. That made me wonder, because, you know, reviewing is sort of a, I don't know, it's a mug's game, to use an old phrase, right? Like, I really wonder how I'm going to feel about this on a rewatch when it comes out on streaming, and then how I deal with it when it comes to, like I said, the end of the year wrap-up episode. So we'll see. We'll see when I revisit it, if I end up seeing more flaws than on my first pass. But I still feel like, pound for pound, giving the nod to scary over comedy, which is like a tiebreaker to me in terms of quality, I still feel like it's the best horror movie I've seen this year so far. But I don't think it's crazy at all to feel like you think that the best horror movie you saw this year is Last Night of the Devil or Immaculate or Lisa Frankenstein. I think the good news really is just a quarter of the way into the year is we have some good contenders. We have movies that are in an interesting dialogue with each other in terms of subject matter. There are a lot of Frankenstein movies that have happened in recent years and are still coming up, or at least Frankenstein themed, right? Like Poor Things, that was just dominant at the Oscars. And religious movies. I don't want to get political or sociological on this kind of podcast. So, like, let's just leave it at, you know, it's a time where people self-reporting in terms of the strength of their religious beliefs and church attendance is at an all-time low in Western countries. And that puts religion in the corner, and a cornered animal is dangerous. anything that's cornered, anything that's being diminished or shrinking or feels like it's losing its grasp on influence or power can be considered dangerous. It doesn't mean they'll necessarily act dangerously, but they could, right? They could feel threatened. And it's very interesting that within a span of a couple weeks, we got two movies about this creeping religious orthodox force seeing an antichrist as almost a blessing to turn people back to their kind of beliefs that they want them to have. So I think 2024 is off to a really good start horror-wise, better than I remember 23 starting out as. So that is good news. And that is my review of The First Omen. I will update on a future podcast the comments that come in or other reviews that come in, both from our subscriber groups and the pages, the Horror Weekly community at large. I probably should be waiting a couple weeks to do these reviews to have people have more of a chance to see these movies. But I'm, as you all know by this point, I'm very excitable. And I just want to talk about what I'm excited about, which is what I just saw. So thank you for bearing with my character flaws. And for listening at all, and for participating and contributing. And for anyone who dialogues back from these podcasts, whether in the form of really thoughtful reviews, which I really appreciate, especially on the Apple platform where you can actually write words and not just give stars. Not that I'm demeaning the Spotify reviews. Those are also really helpful to help get this show to a wider audience. But also to people who message the page and start conversations and do all the things that make this podcast what it is. And that's it for now. Until next Thursday, have a great Horror Week.